Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today is the first in a series of podcasts where we're going to be focusing on the works of Climate Resolve, a nonprofit here based in Los Angeles, headed up by my good friend Jonathan Parfrey. They're all about climate resilience and climate adaptation. So we're going to have two staff members today talking about their work with creating cool communities, Catherine Baltazar and Leah Cohen. Delighted to have them on the podcast today. Hi, Catherine and Leah. Welcome to the podcast. How are you both today?
Pretty good. No complaints.
Pretty good. And I know that Leah's in Mid-City. Are you also in LA as we speak, Catherine?
No, I actually live in Long Beach now.
Oh, you do? Okay. Mm-hmm. You defected. You went. What was that? South or west? So before we get into your backgrounds and all, what are you working on today? I've already introduced your titles. I've already said we're going to be talking about cool communities. What's the focus this week? Why don't we start with you, Catherine?
As you know, we'll probably get a chance to talk about it a little bit more, but really working on getting that Boyle Heights EPA grant application in. That's been our goal for the past couple of months. So it always takes a lot of my time nowadays. And then we have a lot of exciting events in the community that we're doing over the next couple of weeks. So there's a good balance between like background work and then front facing community work.
We will talk about the Boyle Heights project, and this is so exciting. How about you, Leah? What's on your docket?
Yeah, similarly, managing a couple of different projects. There's our work in South LA and Baldwin Hills that we're starting to kick off a new phase of. Our work in the South LA Eco Lab with the Transformative Climate Communities. But my main focus this week has been in Commerce. We're working with the City of Commerce to create a transit-oriented development and displacement avoidance plan. And so I was out there today trying to spread the word so that we can get folks to come to our upcoming listening session next week to provide community feedback on the plan.
How great. I just get the impression that you guys are thriving at Climate Resolve, and that Climate Resolve is growing in stature, growing in relevance. And, you know, did you ever think that you would be involved with such an organization?
I actually looked forward to working at Climate Resolve for a couple of years, I think since I graduated from college in 2016. So it's actually nice to be, you know, at the dream work.
That's fantastic. Well, okay, let's jump into it. You both were born and raised in Los Angeles. And let's start with you, Catherine. You were born in the heart of LA, and you even called it the urban jungle. How do you think that, how did that shape, you know, you and your career?
Oh my gosh. My upbringing has shaped everything I've done, you know, for a very long time. My family's from Guatemala. They're both immigrants and both my parents. And so a lot of the work that I've done has really revolved around like the conditions of my community growing up, being like right outside of downtown, having very limited access to green spaces. At the time, we didn't even have the expo line that took us to the beach. If we wanted to go to the beach, and my family and a lot of people in the community didn't drive because it was expensive to drive. And so if we wanted to go to the beach, for example, I remember having to take the 720 bus for like 3 hours because it always got stuck in traffic. And so it was like an all day thing to go to the beach for a couple hours. Going to Griffith Park was also another journey. So all of those things, it really showed me that I'd really love it if communities like mine across the city of Los Angeles, across the county, across, you know, the country could have access to those spaces because we deserve that. We everybody, you know, who wants to be able to access those spaces should be able to do that without barriers making it difficult. And so I feel like a lot of the work that I've done now has really revolved around like, what does the community want and how can we facilitate that and make that happen for them?
That is so awesome. And I can't omit this from your resume, but how did it come about that you ended up going to Wellesley College?
Oh, well, so for me, I always knew that I wanted to leave LA because I think that if I knew I was going to stay in LA, I wasn't going to like really change my perspective of the world. And I didn't want to feel jaded about how I went about doing the work that I wanted to do. And I felt that the only way to do that is to really like make myself uncomfortable in spaces that I've never been. And so I remember someone talked to me about like, hey, have you considered going to private college? I think at the time I wanted to go to UCLA. And then I said, I'm never leaving LA. Someone was like, you have no idea what's out there. You should really check it out and see. And they recommended Wellesley to me. And so I remember I was like, oh, okay. Like Wellesley, it's a women's college. I have three brothers. I don't have any sisters. I was just like, women only. I was a tomboy growing up. And I was just like, if I can do that. But I visited, I did like one of those like spring open campus visits, and I was blown away because it is such a contrast to being from downtown LA. Like it was beautiful. There's a lake on campus. And I just like, when I walked in that campus, I was like, whoa, I could see myself doing my homework by the lake. I can see myself watching the trees change because of the seasons and all of that. All of those things are new to me. And I just knew that I wanted to do that. I wanted to like see the world now. And so that's how it happened. I wound up getting a full ride to Wellesley College. And it was just like a dream come true for my experience.
Boy, that is to your credit for pursuing that and making that happen and having that major influence in your life. And then Leah, what about you? You're also born and raised in LA.
Yes, I was born in Santa Monica, grew up in the San Fernando Valley. My community and upbringing also, I think, completely grounded and shaped what I've gone on to do. I was born into a family with five brothers, so staying on the brother theme here, wow. And also an adopted sister. And we had many people kind of live with us in their various times of need. It was just very much like open door kind of home that people came in and out. And so for me, from the beginning, I feel like my values were very much rooted in community care and making sure everybody is heard, especially people who aren't usually. And thinking about how to create a life where people have opportunity and can thrive to, you know, give their gifts to the world. And so for me, I was like very much shaped by that tight-knit community. I went to a school out there in the valley. And then I was kind of like opposite from Kat. Like I went from that kind of small tight-knit community into like a big public university when I went to UCLA.
Well, and then congratulations, you killed it there. You got a summa cum laude in UCLA. So that speaks to you as well. So what about early jobs? Kat, you started off at Civic Spark, which is a really unique organization. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Civic Spark is actually an AmeriCorps program. It's 11 months. And for me, it was an opportunity to really explore something professionally that I hadn't thought about before. I think when you graduate from college, you're kind of naive and like thinking, the first job I get is the one that I'm going to be in for the rest of however long. And yeah. So for me, when I was in college, I was doing a lot of like different kind of advocacy type of work, doing photojournalism. And there was a huge part of me that still wanted to potentially go into policy work and look at what policy looks like across the various scales of like local, state, federal government. And so when I first came across the Civic Spark program, there was an option to be placed within the county of Los Angeles, the public health department, and working on urban heat island reduction plan that the county was developing. So that was like, oh, this is perfect. This is my chance to like figure out if I'm built out to be working in local government. And I did my fellowship there and I realized, wow, there is an organizer in me that this is incredibly dissatisfied with how slowly bureaucratic processes are. And I realized I'm not sure if I can stay in local government. Like this is a little too slow for me. I need to see change because I come from communities that need change almost immediately. So that's Civic Spark.
Yeah, that's great. And then Leah, after you graduated, you ended up going to Ohio and working on a campaign. Is that right? It was a swing state, and you were dedicated.
Yes. Yeah. So in college, I was kind of focused on a lot of different issues that mattered to me. I studied international development and public affairs and then minor in environmental systems. And I was kind of looking at the things that I cared about through different lenses, from like economic development, labor studies, gender justice. And for me, climate kind of wasn't like the focus going into it. It just kind of emerged for me as kind of this underlying actor that was accelerating all of these other injustices that I was seeing. And So I was set to graduate in 2020, right into the COVID pandemic. And I was like, oh, like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want to impact these issues that I care about. So I went out to become a field organizer for the Ohio Coordinated Campaign for the 2020 election, working to elect Democrats up and down the ballot. And my turf was like Cleveland and Akron. I was actually based out of LA. It was the first ever virtual field organizing effort, which was like a big feat to take on at the time because it was very early Zoom days. But we were pretty successful in getting a lot of resources spent out there and doing well on some local elections. And obviously we didn't win Ohio at the federal level, but it did play our part in that election. So that was my virtual organizing experience out there before I came back here.
You both of you are so grassroots. I was reading about your workplace discrimination, sexual harassment, just this whole focus on environmental justice. And when I got involved with climate action planning and greenhouse gas inventories, there really was no folk, and there was no discussion of climate justice or it's environmental justice. And it's just fantastic. I mean, you two are just embodying that in your work. Let's talk about some of the projects. Let's jump into the Boyle Heights project in particular. Kat, can you describe that?
Oh, I still need to get my one sentence description for that project, but it has been a comprehensive effort developed literally by community and for community. Right now, the community of Boyle Heights is impacted across like its geographical location by a variety of environmental impacts. The community of Boyle Heights is divided in half by a freeway interchange of 5 freeways that cut through it. It also has an industrial corridor that's incredibly heavy industry of rail yards. It's got, paint facilities. It's got car manufacturing facilities. It's got a variety of industry in there. And it's just been home. It's also adjacent to this Exide impact that happened. So Exide was a battery recycling facility that was just polluting the city of Vernon, and all of those impacts rolled over into the adjacent community of Boyle Heights. And so the community has just been seeing environmental impacts for a very long time, and they've been advocating a lot. And they advocated a lot for the closure of Exide, which was successful in 2012. And so, the community has just is ready to be able to get the infrastructure it needs to adapt to these impacts. And this project really stemmed from that. We're hoping to do a variety of improvements, including adding more greenery. The community doesn't have trees. It doesn't have a lot of urban parks. So we're hoping to do some tree planting. We've got in line to do some cool roof replacement and solar panels. We're working on adding in some sidewalk improvements and curb ramps. We're working on building a resilience hub in one of the public housing facilities. There's a lot that goes in. We're also working on, doing community engagement in a way that makes the community participate in that process. And it's just an incredibly extensive and comprehensive program and project that we've been developing out with a variety of community partners.
It's really, really awesome. And one of the sad ironies, I guess, of your works is that as you create, as Boyle Heights, because of all of this, I consider it acupressure exercise. You're bringing in all these resources and you're cooling this community. And then you've got to face the whole issue of gentrification. How do you react to that?
I'm from a community of color. We see this already. I see this in my community now. It's the crutch of it all, right? It's communities of color, and really communities across the world deserve to live in spaces where they're resource rich, where they have access to what they need to survive and thrive and be healthy. And so for us to be able to come and do this work with communities is important. We can't, avoid doing this work. The hard part is obviously that there's capitalism and there's profit-driven folks. And, once you improve a community, then it's a community that's attractive to live in. Now it's a place that deserves more investment. And before, especially with histories of redlining, there's a lack of investment in these communities that really caused for conditions to exist the way they are now. And being able to do this work is important to keep that context in mind. We can't go in it blind. We can't go in it deaf, with deaf ears. We have to listen to what community priorities are. And it's part of the reason why for this particular project, we're actually working with a community land trust to develop a displacement avoidance plan rooted in community empowerment, rooted in community education, and then power, giving them the information they need to make decisions that matter to them, giving them opportunities to be informed and to be able to advocate for what they need throughout the entire process is essential for us.
I agree with Kat. Obviously, it's complicated because we know so much that when you cool down a community, when you make it more beautiful, then folks who haven't traditionally been there all of a sudden after years of disinvestment and redlining are like ready to pour in their money. And so where you're not trying to create an environment that pushes out residents, but at the same time, folks who have been fighting for their own public health, for their community, for their right to clean air and to live in a way that feels good and cool, especially with rising temperatures, like they have that right. And so to do these community-led projects that bring investment into these spaces, I think we're all trying to think together, how can we do it in a way that can still preserve community identity and have residents reap the benefits of all this investment that they've brought in. So for me, working in the City of Commerce, we had a sustainable transportation equity project grant that brought $3.2 million of investment from the California Air Resources Board into the community for 400 trees. Two zero emission buses and Dalla ride shuttles, and then their first ever set of bike lanes, now also it's funding the development of a transit oriented development and displacement avoidance plan. And this is kind of a new earth thing that we're hoping is helpful and actually has some teeth and that the city can implement in order to make sure that residents can stay in Commerce. And that one is specifically around the development of the metro line that's coming into the Citadel station in 2035. So we're planning like more than a decade in advance for what kind of investments communities want to see and renter and homeowner protections we can have for folks who are already there. And the same thing goes for our South LA Ecolab project. That one brought in $35 million of investment. Wow. Through the Strategic Growth Council to this one small area in South LA. And so obviously that was one after literally decades of organizing and a coalition of, I think, like 18 community organizations. And so that one is also funding some displacement avoidance planning that we hope can let residents benefit from this investment that they've worked so hard to bring to their communities.
So what would be a tool for displacement avoidance? Would it be like rent control provisions, or what are the most common tools for that?
Or
there no one. Really good tools? Maybe there's no really good tools.
We're all trying to figure out. There's the ones that like everyone would want if you were just saying like this is the best thing, but you also need something that the city is in a place to implement and to enforce, right? So we're working right now with a firm called Estolano Advisors, just starting out to do the plan for Commerce. And yeah, I think there's going to be exploration of what kind of like renter protections can you have, homeowner protections. There's different things that have to do with like housing codes and policies and ways to protect communities who are there. But it kind of gets into the weeds on that. And I think, folks are trying to figure out what works best in a way that these cities, which are pretty understaffed and small and kind of at capacity, can actually implement and enforce. Because you can have every plan in the world, but these cities that are pretty stretched thin, like what are they actually going to do? And so we're trying to have that closer relationship with the city so that it can be meaningful to the residents that are providing this feedback.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I remember Kat telling me about some of the community processes in Boyle Heights. And even just coming up with the name of the project, I was like, mm-hmm. You got to come up with a simple name. And Kat said, hey, there's nothing simple about that. You have a lot of different, you have a lot of different opinions that you're working with, right?
Yeah, I was going to actually say that. So I think for housing, it's one thing to look at like the side that Leah's looking at, which is like policy development and enforcement and implementation. But the other thing really that we're finding in the housing space, Climate Resolve is part of a housing coalition called Our Future LA. that brings in just organizations across the city and county that are working on housing as an umbrella issue. And then you have folks doing a variety of things under that. But the biggest thing we would say really ties back to this like grassroots lens of community ownership. The problem is always that folks don't own where they live. And if like oftentimes more than 50% of these BIPOC communities are renters. And so keeping that in mind when you're talking about a like policy landscape, you will need to also include an opportunity for ownership within that space. And so right now our coalition has been working on, and this is why community land trusts are important. They help keep ownership in the community and for the community. And so we are looking at policies that could actually like help community land trusts buy properties within their communities that they're in. And it's also oftentimes you have tenants should have access, like first right of purchase access when their building goes for sale. Because that tends to happen. A building can go for sale and then some management company from who knows where shows up, buys it, raises the rent, evicts people, all of this stuff. But if tenants are able to get the first opportunity for purchase, then they're able to keep their property within the community. And things like that tend to have a more direct impact and direct benefit than long-term policy creation that tends to like, again, tie back into that bureaucratic hurdle of working with six city officials, enforcement, all those details that can take a long time. And by that point, community could be displaced and gentrified.
Yeah. Now you both seem pretty optimistic. this seems like really hard work. I mean, when I started thinking about the interview, I thought we were going to talk about, you know, cool surfaces, cool pavements and cool roofs and cool walls. And that's, you know, that sort of technology, I guess, which is important, but the onion is the layers are being peeled back and you're saying to really have a vibrant community, a healthy community with access, that there's all of these other dimensions, like you said, ownership, community ownership, housing ownership. How do you, Leah, are you optimistic that this model is something that's viable and can spread, can scale?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be optimistic to do this work. We're going against really big forces, right? Global climate change and economic forces and the world that we live in. But for me, and I think for Kat and so many of us, we get inspiration and just like working hand in hand with the people who are here to face the issues that are in front of us. And I know that that's not enough in the grand scheme of things, in the work that we need to do to mitigate and transform our economies and decarbonize and all the things that we're working on. But it's a piece, and it's communities that are not thought about a lot in this transition are the communities here that are on the ground, and they need help now, right? Not just they need help, they need investment. They're ready. They're ready to meet the moment. They're organized, they're connected, and they're not getting the funds. And I think for the first time, and at least in U.S. history, we're starting to recognize that more deeply. You know, we have at the federal level the IRA and infrastructure investments, and for the first time, a lot of climate legislation that is intended through Justice 40 and others to actually go to these communities that it's for so long hasn't gone to. And so there is kind of, at least at the capital level, some investment that says it at least looks like it's going towards scaling this type of work. And I think it needs to be done. I think we need all hands on deck when it comes to climate action. I think there's kind of these two things going on at once, where it's like we need really rapid transformation, but at the same time, we need to move at the speed of trust and move alongside community. I like that. And so for me, it's kind of balancing those things. And, you know, whether it's, as you said, like deploying new technologies, like cool services and building knowledge about what are some of these interventions that maybe we wouldn't know about or that are actively coming out. Sometimes it's uplifting recommendations that are already community members already have and just finding investment for them. And so it looks different at different times, but I'm optimistic that when we're more connected, we will be better prepared for what's coming. And we'll at least have solidarity in each other and in our ideas and in our connection.
Oh, that's fantastic. You are so eloquent. And I love what you're saying. Kat, do you share that same, are you finding the same optimism or that same fulfillment with what you're doing in your career?
I am. It's a bit of both, honestly. Like, there's optimism that comes, but there's also understanding. Like, the difference, I think, is that I'm a woman of color, and I grew up in these communities. And so when I'm talking to community members, I'm not talking as someone who's an outsider to the spaces. I'm talking from a lived experience perspective that I hold. And that's always been, like, my favorite part of doing this work, is that we're all driven by where we come from. In the communities that we work with, I'm able to speak their language, and there's, like, a different type of connection that comes in when I'm doing this work. And sometimes it's not even work. Like, this is what I would want for my community, and my community extends beyond that, you know? And as much as I benefit from educational privilege, from having gone to college and being able to access, like, citizenship, right? Because I was born here, and a lot of the community members that I work with don't have that language privilege of being bilingual. And so there's a lot of those things that really fuel the work that I do, because their voice is already so proud and present. And we really, like Leah was mentioning, need to, like, elevate that. Like, yeah. I remember when I was at Civic Spark doing, you know, work in the county, and, like, the big buzzword back then was equity. And I remember being like, oh, it's so interesting that in 2016, we're thinking about equity. And it's like, we have communities who've been, like, dealing with that their whole lives, you know, and now we're seeing this investment, 2024, that's 8 years later, like, finally seeing investment. And, like, sometimes, you know, that kind of timeline can make people feel jaded. Like, you're talking, you know, Leah brought up, the folks in South LA have been organizing for 10 years before seeing a $35 million investment over 10 years. That's kind of nothing, you know? And so it's oftentimes, like, you're also working against that. You have community members who are like, we have been organizing for 20 plus years and we still haven't seen anything. But their motivation and drive to keep going despite that is what drives me, I think, at the end. And so it's like, I could come with all these ideas, but really it's like, recognizing the work that they've put in, the history of all of that, and then tying that into what we can elevate and amplify in our work. Because climate change isn't something that's ever been, like, a second thought for anybody. That ties in almost, like, intersectionally with all of the other stuff that's our priorities for communities of color, economic growth, gender growth, like, all of those things tie into what climate change is. Like, our communities have been sustainable for a very long time, not out of, like, a perspective of environmentalism, but a perspective of, like, survival. And so I think, you know, it's important to, like, stay optimistic, but also be realistic with our communities that we can't bring in this, like, idea that, oh, you know, in the next couple of years, you'll see it. They're like, well, it's been 20 years. Are we really going to see it? Like, you have to keep that in mind when you're doing this work. So it's like optimism at a certain volume level.
Yeah.
Can I add one?
You can certainly add in. Just, it takes a drumbeat, doesn't it? You just have to keep going. Go ahead, Leah, please.
Yeah, no, I just, in response to Kat, yeah, on, like, the timing of it, it's definitely really long term. And I think that can be frustrating too, because even, like, if you take the work that we've been doing in Baldwin Hills, right, we were, like, hired to do this, or we got a grant to do, to create a resilience and access plan for the Baldwin Hills Parklands, which is, like, this haven of green space nestled right between the Inglewood oil fields, West LA and South LA. South LA has really disproportionate access to green space. And so the question was, how do we increase transportation access to the parkland? And we're doing a bunch of transportation advocacy around that. And then also, how do we increase climate resilience in the parks? And we had to do this 18-month planning process. We had a survey, we had resident advisory group members, we had public work group meetings, we had community meetings, we had community design sessions, and all of this to say at the end of it, we came out with this long list of recommendations for transportation improvements, for resilience improvements, having, like, climate resilient infrastructure at parks. So, like, shade structures, water, cool pavement, Wi-Fi, things like that. And, you know, we had to do all this work to kind of prove that there's community desire and need for this. And if you look over at another side of town or in, like, Beverly Hills, like, that's just what any park would have. Yeah. And in these communities that were forever redlined and disinvested, you have to do years of organizing to prove to funders that it even, like, there's a need for that. And so I get inspiration out of that organizing, because I think in doing it, you know, you create a lot of connection and you create a strong case to bring in this investment. But it can also be frustrating, because those same investments are being made without question in other parts of the city. And LA has one of the highest urban heat island effects in the country, I think, in the state. And we also see, like, super disproportionate access to green space and tree canopy along economic and racial lines. And so I get inspiration in like, you know, reversing some of that work, but it also is frustrating that it takes so much time and so much effort for those voices to be considered real and meaningful and worthy of investment in a way that others just get it like right off the bat.
I've got to ask, very well put. And let's wrap with this. How do you keep balance? I saw, Leah, that you are a musician. What is your instrument?
I play a couple instruments. I mainly play guitar, piano, and percussion, but I grew up also playing like violin and some other stringed instruments.
So music is a part of your life. And then I saw basketball and hiking. It sounds like a lot of outdoor activities as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like to, outside of work, I like to stay moving. I love sports. I love playing sports, watching sports. We're super passionate about the growth of women's sports, and then music and art and creativity, and just allowing to like ground myself in that. Those two things kind of keep me balanced.
What a great year for women's sports. I agree. And Catherine, how about you? How do you keep balance? You're working so hard.
Honestly, I have not come up with an answer for that question. I'm unfortunately like a terrible workaholic because, like I said, like this work isn't work for me. It's what I love to do. And yeah, yeah, it's a passion. And so, you know, stepping back from it, I'm always thinking, you know, I go for walks a lot. I ride my bike. I'm a cyclist. And I do a lot of those things, but oftentimes, like, I'm always thinking about like things I could do to improve the work I'm doing, strategies to do engagement, all of that. Like, I'm always thinking like that. So if I could ever answer that question with like, I like to go to yoga, that would be a miracle.
We're working on it for Kat. She's an avid reader.
I am an avid reader. Yeah. I read a book a week.
Oh, that's incredible. All right. Well, listen, thank you. Thank you both for what you're doing. Really, really, really important work, really inspiring work. And let's have another conversation in a couple of years. We'll talk about your progress. Thanks again.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's EcoLogic. We'll see you next time.